Welcome to Docs in Orbit, where we feature conversations with independent creative documentary filmmakers from around the world. This is Christina Zachariadis. Thank you so much for taking time to sit with me today. I was incredibly moved by your film.
Thank you. No, I'm really thrilled to do this conversation also because it's rare to talk to people who are so specifically steeped within the documentary craft. So I'd love to have this chat. Very happy and relieved to have a face-to-face conversation.
Me too, yeah. Well, welcome and congratulations on your film, on what you've been able to accomplish so beautifully in All That Breathes. I mean, I remember I was watching the film with Eka, who is a contributor to the podcast, and within 5 minutes I was like, why am I crying? Like, why am I already crying in the very first early scenes of it? And I think it's just like the ecological crisis that we're living in is so immense and so emotional that when you start to even tap on the surface of it in such a gentle way, it just kind of opens up a lot of emotions. And I just want to congratulate you on being able to navigate not only the ecological story that is really important and urgent, but then also interweaving like the humanity of that as well. And I thought that was just like an immense amount of grace and wisdom that is just pouring through this film.
Thank you so much. It's the thing is, because you're not physically located with the screenings, I've just not heard back from people enough, and it's largely only been tweets, etc. And it's very good to hear. Like, thank you so much for saying that.
Yeah, and it really made me reflect a lot about so many things, and we're going to explore that all in this conversation. One of the things that I'd really like to just start off with is understanding what drew you to documentary as a form of artistic expression, because I know that you work as a researcher as well.
Well, the one thing is that I think a lot of us gravitated towards nonfiction because the simpler answer was that it was more hospitable for a lot of people in terms of funding, resources. It was something that you could do yourself. And I was profoundly influenced by the work of Gianfranco Rossi, Victor Kosakowski, Patricio Guzman, etc. And there was a kind of poetry in their work which assimilated a kind of fascination with the real, which is, of course, the more conventional sort of heart of documentary practice, but also the ease of which a lot of them developed grammars of finding the poetic or the lyrical in everyday humdrum, banal life. And that was very, very, this kind of intersection, especially within the creative documentary form, wherein life is observed, but it isn't just ethnographic or observational in a thin reportage way, but there is a kind of deep substantive poetry behind it. So for instance, in Rossi's work, when you have just these kind of snapshot vignettes of everyday life, and through it, you see these dense kind of tapestries of the local culture, the kind of embedded politics and so on, and there's something really special happening there. And sometimes fiction gets there, and I'm also deeply interested in fiction, but what nonfiction allows is a kind of long engagement with a particular concept and the stuff of everyday human life that I think fiction often struggles with, but also nonfiction is able to extract from particular film vocabularies and grammars of fiction. And that makes it especially interesting, especially in the work of Rossi and then Victor Kosakowski, whose visual artistry just dazzled a lot of us. And I'm talking about a small group of friends, a lot of who collaborate together in Delhi, who are just blown away by this kind of creative documentary form. For me personally, because I have a background in research and academics, I'm deeply interested in concepts, in ideas, you know? So for instance, in my previous film, my first film, it was called Cities of Sleep, but the idea was to think of the city through the lens of sleep or through a kind of horizontal axis. So the genesis of Cities of Sleep was that I was deeply inspired by the work of this French philosopher called Jacques Rancière and this text called Nights of Labor, which sort of reconfigured sleep as a deeply political process and what it means when we sleep and how that exercises relations of power and so on. And that was a kind of springboard or the kicking off point for me to go out to different night shelters and start thinking about sleep and how one can make a film about sleep. So we found people who were interesting vectors of that idea and then followed them for 2-3 years. In a way, this film was about disassembling the urban or the city space through the lens of birds or non-human life in a city. And so we then started looking for people who had a deep and profound relationship with either the skies or with birds, and then chanced upon the main characters of this film. So it's this sort of like the process here is thinking of a broader idea and then finding characters who are able to communicate it through the singular circumstances of their lives. So there is a kind of like deep synergy between reading about something, being utterly gripped by a concept, and then going out into the world to see how it articulates itself in a kind of everyday way. So that's how the research end of it and the filmmaking end of it sort of synergize.
Yeah, because I also read that you had done a fellowship at Cambridge University on this idea of urban ecology. Mm-hmm. And that was back in 2018. And so from a timeline perspective, I was wondering what you uncovered, what your area of study was, and then how that kind of influenced the creation of this film. And as like a parenthesis on that too, you mentioned non-human. It reminded me of the work of Timothy Morton. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. I'm not an expert at all in this, but it's sort of like philosophy of interconnectedness and of like where is nature, the idea of nature. Yeah. And that's definitely in the film in every single frame and every level of the way that you created the film and what's inside of it. But yeah, I think I just would love to hear you talk a little bit about the research that you were doing at Cambridge and expand on this term of more than human.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Sure. Okay, so in a way, the genesis was from long conversations over coffee and drinks with a dear friend of ours called Man Barwa, who teaches at Cambridge. And I was there for a very brief fellowship, but basically I was housed in the human geography department, and everybody around me was working on what they loosely sort of defined as the more than human. The more than human is a kind of approach where the human is not the absolute reference point or the central point of analysis, etc., and you pay deep attention to other kinds of life forms, and therefore the term more than human. And I was surrounded by, you know, people who were working on dogs in Chernobyl or vegetation in Fukushima or polar bears. And you also mentioned Timothy Morton. And Timothy Morton is part of this sort of bandwidth of excellent writing that looks at interconnectedness and entanglement and a broader sort of discourse on the Anthropocene, etc., that all of which was part of stuff that I was consuming for over a year. But in the conversations with Man, we started discussing this sort of perspective. And over time, I encountered other pieces of literature that were deeply, deeply inspirational for me. For instance, J.A. Baker's book called The Peregrine, which is about this person's sort of hypnotic, ravenous obsession with this one falcon species called the peregrine. And it's just like, I don't think I've read a more acute piece of literature than and moving piece of literature in terms of pure documentary observation of one form. And, you know, when you really train your gaze at one thing and keep looking at it, it illuminates itself in various different ways. And that was the kind of quality that the Peregrine had. Or, for instance, Etches for Hawk. And a panoply of these kinds of books, which are about human-animal relationships. And I was reading these books. I was having these long conversations over coffee with friends there. And like, wonderful work that people have done around how animal life is improvising to the growth of cities and all of that. And then also seeing how things played out in the global south, right? And especially in Delhi. And when you grow up in Delhi, you're just constantly aware of the singular experience of growing up in these gray, hazy, monotone skies. And the sense that this kind of a hostile environment is laminating every aspect of your life. You're breathing in noxious air. And there's this kind of thing that it's a sensorium that envelops everything, you know, and the sense that the air conditioner of planet Earth has gone awry, like something is just chugging and blowing dangerous fumes at us. And the sense of uncanniness about the atmosphere itself becoming foundationally antipathetic or hostile towards was a growing sort of a thing. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the discourse around environmentalism, I find uninteresting in this. It either sort of has a kind of bleeding heart sentimentality to it. And especially when we met the brothers, they kind of embodied a perspective that was deeply interesting to me, which is a kind of, they literally have the front row seats to the apocalypse, right? Birds are falling off the sky and every day they're landing in their tiny derelict basement. And they still have this kind of a wry sense of soldiering on, of putting your head down and getting on with it, while also being philosophers of the urban. So there are also people who are making very acute commentaries on broader behavioral changes, ecological changes in the city. They're talking about how squirrels are now acting differently and, you know, things that they've picked up with only observational experience for decades now. And so these are like the vague kind of synergies where this whole bunch of books, this bunch of conversations and people, philosophers talk and so on. And then this thing of finding people in the world, allowing the singular specificities of their life to take over fully, but at least the scaffolding beneath it, the bulwark beneath it, is the conceptual edifice that you started with.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the edit, finding a kind of form where you let go of everything and just finally working with the best permutations of that material. So then it, I think, contains a kind of layering of the conceptual beginning that you started with, and then, you know, finding the best kind of aesthetic shape of it.
Yeah, that's, I can tell the influences, like the philosophical thought of interconnectedness, which is right now there's a lot of writing around it. It is dense sometimes, that the tonality of it and the highly academicness of it can sometimes be overwhelming, and right, you're not sure what to do with those concepts. But then yet, you know, in this film, you make it so visible, and it felt like a real tangible expression of some of these real kind of like conceptual ideas that are in the ether right now and in the world. And I was going to ask a little bit about the poetic voiceover. So one of the things that resonated specifically with Saud and Nadim, was it Nadim that was voicing over most of it, or was
it Saud?
A lot
of stuff is taken from his interviews, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask about, because it's so rich in insight and it just blooms with wisdom. And some of the quotes I still think about today, even, you know, a few days later after watching the film, and I think it's going to stay with me even, you know, like forever. So this idea of like looking at the black kite and talking about it in terms of swimming in the sky, and this, how every life form adjusts to the city. And there's just so many quotes in the film that were just like incredibly poetic. I was wondering about how the process of writing the script for the film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So we remember the film has been shot for over 3 years, right? This meant like long, long conversations with them and hours of interviews and so on, and informal chats and so on. And what we started doing was that I started maintaining a very thick kind of diary or archive of interesting throwaway things that they would keep saying. And they're not articulate in an obvious way. They're soft-spoken, often introverted people. And every now and then there'd be a throwaway line about, you know, about life itself being a kind of kinship. It would sort of grip me then, and I'd think about it later. So we maintained a ledger of all of these things that were very interesting. And I started scripting this kind of poetic voiceover where we'd sprinkle this in a very structured kind of a way. And so it was deeply collaborative in the sense of like things that they have said in conversation, etc., that you then start sculpting and chiseling in a way where it best fits. And of course, that involves a lot of scripting in the sense of how one aestheticizes it. I was sure that in terms of the grammar of the film, that we would have these kind of verite sequences, but also not shy away from a grammar which goes into these lyrical meandering cameras that go into the camera going into the sky, and you see just birds, or you see the reflection of things on water and so on. And that actually marries well with this kind of a poetic consciousness. So the job of the voiceover was to talk about the past. A very crucial aspect of the film is essentially about two brothers falling in love with the birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you invoke this sense of this kind of hypnotic, obsessive love with this one thing? And how do you like, I really wanted to communicate the blunt force that I felt after meeting them. This, and how does one communicate that in a regular Verite grammar? So we needed a kind of language that was able to facilitate this kind of a lyrical approach. So which is where this kind of like broader poetic sections came in. Also, I think what happens is that if a film has these different kind of layers, it's richer and it gives a kind of richer tapestry of things that you feel and so on. And also allows for, you know, emotional things that people feel deep within to come out. So if Nadeem says that he's not happy with what's happening, these are all emotional textures that get opened up if you say that it's okay for us to speak in a kind of lyrical vocabulary. And it just opens up more things. And I think generally documentaries are more interesting when they're opening themselves up to these other grammars. I don't know if that answers your question,
No,
but
absolutely. And just to build off of that, when you're talking about Nadim and his expression of grief, that was another powerful moment. Just this idea of how the film deals with grief within the ecological crisis that we're in. And your film doesn't run away from that. There's this moment in the film where Nadim is talking about his very real depressive feelings. And there's this image in the film where you show us all the birds that they couldn't save. And there is a philosophy of thought that we have to make room for that also. You know, we have to make room for the gravity of the ecological crisis that we're facing and the feelings and emotions that surfaces within us. And I mean, and I'm thinking right now, I'm thinking about like Naomi Klein talks a lot about this, and it was shown in the film, but it was also shown how they're able to move through that grief and still tend to the ecological wounds. We have this idea like birds are falling from the sky, there's this economic and political challenges that the protagonists are facing. And I was just wondering like how, having watched the film at the very end, we still kind of are left with hope, you know. There's
That's a really good question. Let me start out from a more zoomed out perspective of what we began with in terms of the structural logic of the film, and then a kind of contrasting emotional logic that came from the brothers, and how the film eventually became a kind of mishmash of both those things. When we first started with the brothers, I was sure that this had to be a sense of a fairy tale that has gone horribly wrong, a fairy tale that has gone dystopic. So it begins with two brothers who fall desperately in love with a bird species. And I wanted to, like, the idea was to first be able to communicate this kind of ravenous love for this one bird and what they felt in terms of its beauty in the sky and the sense of looking at into its eye when they got their first injured bird, and this kind of wondrous otherworldly alienness of the kite, which all of us would feel when we look at raptors, you know, with their ferocious eyes and so on. And the founding idea was that I wanted audiences to step out of the theaters and look up and to enchant the sky, you know, but also this sense of something where you have this kind of fabulous magical kind of thing of what was fit in terms of being filtered through their nostalgia about their childhood love affair with the bird. And then the sense of how things have gotten desperately wrong, also to be aestheticized as a kind of like, there has to be a fairy tale-ish sort of a fabulous element to it. That, when we began, was a purely aesthetic thing, you know. Over time, things changed in terms of how we dealt with the substance of what you are correctly couching as eco grief, we can call it that, and ecological grief. And all of us were, there were also what happened is that through 2021 and all of that, our own lives were like, personally for me, I had a enormous personal tragedy and the biggest loss of my life. Other crew members had like big things that affected their lives, some connected to the pandemic, like big personal losses and like, you know, closest family members passing and all of that. So all of it sort of got mishmashed in ways that are ineffable and impossible right now to sort of chart out, because these are things that you know, like, seem small in prospect but huge in retrospect. And I think all of it moved in a way where a kind of somberness started coming into the film, and a sense of longing and a sort of like where there's something which is searingly lonely, and where you don't know where you stand against the mass delusion of the world, both vis-a-vis the political crisis and the climate crisis, the toxicity of the
Right.
sky and the toxicity of the ground. So all of this, I think, sort of like mishmash in the film is only, I suppose, any kind of work is richer when it allows these different kind of reverberations and resonances to crisscross and not be about one thing but multiple things simultaneously. And in a way, the brothers also not getting along, or like points of difference between them, was also symptomatic of something larger. At one point, South, for instance, says that the petty fights between us is not just about him and me or ego or financial issues, but it's about everything. And thankfully, when he's saying it, a couple of sparrows flutter past, and you feel this sense of, like there's this broader thing of clearly what's happening is this like cosmological wound that has opened up, which gets articulated or symptomized in this tiny kind of a thing. But at the same time, we didn't want it to be bleak. I wanted moments of comicality, which I think Salik brings in with his glasses going off and
Totally.
all of that. But also the sense of, because the brothers are not bleak, there's a, which is why I find this perspective very interesting. And it's very different from this, like the now philosophical postulates of cosmic pessimism and so on, that's fairly big now. Is the sense that, well, things are really getting destroyed and nobody knows this better than the brothers, but that they have to put their work down and get the work done. They're not very self-congratulatory. They're not bleeding heart environmentalists at all. They're not any of that, but they have this quiet, underplayed, wry sort of personality, which is interesting. And the idea was, the film was to get a tinge of that somberness or sadness, but at the same time, hold on to this kind of like, it shouldn't be just plain despair, because that a singular emotion is always boring and beyond a point gets fatigued.
Absolutely. And it's you're painting this real dystopian reality where birds are falling from the sky, and there's also also what's happening with the Muslim minority in Delhi as well. So there's all of this both ecological but then also political and social, but where the hope is in the film is that at the end of the day, they still do the work that they do, and amidst all of this darkness, there's magic, and the magic is in the way that they tend to the wounds of these birds and the attention that they give there. And also, I was really struck by how you show us their challenges that they face. So the social political challenges that they face with being Muslim in this part of Delhi, but also the flooding that happens, the machines that are constantly breaking, their lack of funding. So what was it like for you to witness these brothers doing the extremely important work that they're doing and the challenges of them that they're constantly facing in terms of getting support, funding, all of that sort of stuff?
Of course, it's harrowing and frustrating and maddening to watch,
Yeah.
but also that's what makes the substance of their lives and their character and the story richer, right? Denser. The fact of these vicissitudes and like constant, the dramatic arc of their lives is genuinely dramatic. One thing was that we were like, I was certain that we wanted to find a form that was working on layers. So the inner sanctum of it, so if I had to give a sort of visual representation of it, the inner sanctum is the basement and the life of the brothers themselves and their interpersonal emotional vagaries. And that forms the kind of emotional anchor of the film, right? Beyond that is actually something that comes in through leaks, is the social or the social unrest or the political around them, where in every time they go into the balcony, you hear some thing about a protest happening or something, but you don't really know. And the political is something that we are not directly or frontally interested in the film, but you're made aware of its presence almost in an atmospheric way, right? So the idea was to have a form that is reminiscent of a leak, like things leaking in acoustically through the window or through the balconies. They're going out and they, but of course, what happens is that often the world outside impinges inside and stops you from doing work, which happens towards the second half of the film itself. But that is how life is, right? Like so much of life is that you want to put your head down and do something, but there are macrocosmic force fields that come in the way. Not that you're fully, especially the brothers, while they're politically aware, they don't get completely drawn in because they know, like Saud also says in the film in a conversation with his wife, that of course what's happening outside is important, but what I do, only I do, and I have to go on doing it. So staging that kind of a conflict as well. So that's like the second sort of bubble. The third broader bubble is of the ecological, of things going desperately wrong, birds missing. And they are actually, the brothers themselves are interested more in this kind of cosmological politics of between man and sky, between human and bird, human and more than human, that kind of a thing. And the idea was to find these kinds of bubbles and layers and suture it in a way where all of it gets... So the film is not like a political snapshot of India. It's definitely not that. It's definitely not just about animal activism. And it's most definitely, hopefully, not about nice people doing nice things. It's all of it and at the same time, different things together, which is why I think it gets packed in as a kind of vignette-y snapshot, and that's the kind of form, right? So that kind of a form where, you know, it's like tableaus of where you don't see the name of a character, you don't have text over what city it is, how bad the pollution is, none of that, but you sort of get plunged in midway and you have just these vignettes. And through it, you get these threads interweaving. Was the sort of form that we only arrived at. We didn't start off with it.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask, because there's definitely a structure there, but it's not like a very obvious structure. The film really flows one scene to the next really seamlessly and with ease, and almost it seems like effort, like without effort. But I know that editing is like a big job, and that there was, I mean, because you're working with multiple levels, also the political, the social unrest, the ecological story, the story of the brothers, and then you have this Salik, who really does a tremendous, his storyline really does bring a tremendous amount of levity to the film. So I was wondering about some of these like conversations that you were having with the editor along the way to find that blend.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there are three aspects to the film's grammar. One is the observational verite scenes of the brothers' lives themselves. The lyrical sections, which we had, wherein we had the license to do more lyricized kind of shooting. And the third being what we called life writ large. That's mm-hmm. how we shorthanded it, which is shots of non-human life in the city. And we were reading a bunch of literature, like Darwin Comes to Town, or like a bunch of books where we were looking at how animal life is improvising, adjusting, and reacting to urban. Like the urban is a big sort of way in which behavioral changes and actually evolutionary changes are also being triggered. And that actually I find fairly hopeful, you know, like because there's animal life that is also improvising. It's not like a passive thing that's only getting, you know, animals' life or non-human life is also improvising with things that are changing. And that's playful and at times hopeful. It's definitely not bleak. So these are the sort of like things that we were interested in. And so we spent hours and hours shooting non-human life in the city. So we had three folders: the brothers, the lyrical section, the non-human life. So these are the three folders in on the hard drives. And we did a kind of base edit with Vedant Joshi in Delhi while we were shooting. So there was like simultaneous shooting and editing as it was happening. And we kept sort of like working on the jigsaw puzzle of how these three things would go together. Then we finally moved to Copenhagen for about 4 to 5 months on the edit. And there Charlotte, like any master editor, came and just ripped it to shreds, the structure that we had, and started with her own thing. And she, you know, it's something that I also learned with her, where I usually approach things through a kind of conceptual lens, you know, like this is what it means intellectually or philosophically or like cognitively, whereas she has a kind of like, what does your stomach feel, or what is the intuitive logic, what is the emotional logic of it? And there's a kind of like orchestra composer sort of a sense that she brought in, where it doesn't matter what it means. And it took me some time to figure this out. It's like what it makes you feel is different from what it means. And she sort of brought in this. So the neat kind of clustering of these sequestered, cloistered sections that we had earlier was completely blown out of the water. And she brought in this thing where it would just be like intuitively, what does it feel? And it was a actually incredibly enriching experience, and nothing that I've ever done, where we had an existing 3R edit and we took screenshots of it on a board, and it was just looking at the visual postcards of the board and constantly saying, let's put this there, more than the timeline actually. And then we rearranged things on the board. It was like a mosaic that we were going on playing with. And then she would put it on the timeline the next day, and then we'd see it on the big screen to see how it was flowing. After a while, we let go of what are the exact themes that we want, but had a vague sense of what it was going like. And I sort of like started deferring to hers and Vedant's sense of just a flow. And it's the word flow otherwise is obviously like heavily abused and a bit of a cliche, but this sense of how a scene flows as a structure and then working on the inner logic of it was the editing thing that I think we arrived at eventually, where you don't really think of exactly how you don't really chisel the inner life of a scene, but you put it all together and see how it's flowing in a broader thing. And then once you're arrived at a sort of like 110 minute thing and you have to cut down to 90 is when you work on the inner logics of the scene. Then you cut it all down together and then you say, meaning wise, is there something dangerous that's emerging or that's something that we don't want? And so it's a, I think it's a kind of European and especially Danish style of working that, and Danish editors have been like, the Danish output of documentary per capita has been incredible. I mean, every year you see two or three fantastic, in recent years, think of Flea, President, all these films that come out of this, especially this fantastic studio called Kongolurot Studio there, which I rave about all the time, but they really have a strong, robust documentary culture.
Yeah, I know. And I noticed actually in the end credits the contribution of Nils Anderson as an editing consultant on this. And
Right. And actually, I have to say, Joshua Oppenheimer, the
yeah.
director of Act of Killing, and he came in and was very generous with his time. And of course, is super intelligent and sensitive to the life of a film when it's at a rough stage and all of that, and was extremely helpful in how he, and of course, Nils Anderson is the grand old master of the docu form. And so, and it also, firstly, for me, it was very interesting because it's, I approach film a bit cerebrally, and it get like it might have deleterious effects as well to the editing logic. So it was good to have a kind of editing presence, especially in the form of Charlotte, who would say it might mean that, but it doesn't feel that way. And this kind of constant wrestling between what it means and what it feels often becomes the crux of the edit beyond the base cut. I realize that, which is why you have to put in those 2, 3 months after where you just have to arm wrestle every day in terms of what it's feeling. That was my experience of the edit. And which is why I personally think an editor is super important. Like, I don't know how directors who edit themselves do it. I did a part of it in the previous film, but I don't know how, like, I'm definitely never doing it again.
And also the visual language of the film too. So you had mentioned this third folder that existed in the edit file, which was like the non-human life folder. And if I were to double click on that, I'm sure I would, that's where the images where you're managing to capture a whole universe in one shot, where you have like the water and the reflection of the sky and the flies on the surface of the water. And I read that you worked with three different cinematographers. So I'm curious, what were the conversations like there to be able to get such a cohesive visual style?
Well, the three different cinematographers is only a product of scheduling snafus and COVID and the second wave of COVID and some of us getting COVID and all of that. So it's otherwise I would have loved to work with any one of them through and through. Okay, let me give you a sense of how we approached the kind of visual strategy of the film and what I was telling the cinematographers before we began. So most of these ideas came from this hive mind of the team itself, me, Rohan, Siraj, Aman, Arjun, etc. And we generated a bank or a kitty of shots where we thought we could find either locations or settings or scenographies of human, non-human life and its simultaneity or coexistence being articulated in one shot. So, for instance, maybe we'll find a turtle in this particular garbage heap, and because there's a road which is behind it, we'll probably find a shot of the traffic of the turtle looking at traffic. So we generated this kind of list of things. We were absolutely certain that we didn't want to make a nature doc or a conventional wildlife documentary, and largely A, also because none of us have the skill set for it. We've never done this sort of a thing before. And the idea was to render the scientific of the natural world poetic. That was the core idea. So to find a kind of grammar that was able to shoot, that was able to find these animals in the city, observe it in a, like finding moments in a day that feel poetic when you see it. So we had this list of shots. We first started with Somo, who unfortunately couldn't continue because there were scheduling clashes. And then I was able to convince Ben Bernhardt, the German cinematographer who worked with Kosakowski, to come and shoot. And he came in as a kind of force of nature that transformed and like gave a kind of foundational vision to the film at its first instance. And with him, we found this language where if the main idea was to show coexistence or simultaneity of life smoshed together, he said, how about we develop this language of this slow cinematic pans or tilts or focus shifts where, you know, this thing where you said that there's so much literature on it, which is often inaccessible or only cerebral. I feel like only cinema among all the arts, not written stuff, not oral stuff, only cinema, it has the ability to show simultaneity of life as a temporal unit in terms of you seeing the time of traffic, you see the time of the human world, and then you see a turtle just looking at or contemplating traffic going by. And you have these two sort of durational experiences packed together. So we realized that it had to be languid, and the camera language had to be languid or languorous, where you show two things together. So with Ben, we kept on sort of evolving this language of this very cinematic slow pan that reveals thing, you know, that is revelatory as an and works as an individual unit. So all the life writ large shots, we don't edit in the middle, right? So all these shots in the film, there's no cutting. It's a kind of tableau. It's a kind of like one single frontal tableau. And that's a form that we developed over time. Unfortunately, this was in the middle of the second wave of COVID and life, like everything was helter-skelter, and Ben had to go back. And then we got on this very talented DP called Riju, who came and evolved that language much further. With Riju, we developed this style where even human behavior would be, we'd do this kind of tripoded but moving languid fluid style. So it started with, okay, with the lyricals, we're going to do this. With the life writ large, we're developing the style of slow pants, etc. And then even in the verite, we're going to stay a bit detached. We're going to observe life. We're going to both look at and look with. In a lot of verite documentaries, you're mostly looking with and not looking at. But I also wanted this sense of observing life from a slight distance. And like not making it completely unimmersive, but have this kind of a tableau style. So, I mean, anyway, those are the main pillars of the visual language.
No, that's so excellent that you described it that way, and I think it's so helpful. I mean, I definitely don't want to be watching the film conscious of this, but I think as filmmakers, we all benefit from understanding the ways in which you move through that. I just have one or two more last questions, and I'm looking at the time. Is it okay? I just have one that I'm dying to ask, which is about the title of the film, All That Breathes. As you just described, even in the panning shot, the philosophy of interconnectedness, the philosophy of this like horizontal plane where humans coexist with these non-humans and the impact that humans have on them. All of that it's in the framing as well, in the way that you just described, like the panning, the horizontal movement. And I know that All That Breathes is a statement that the brothers inherited from their mother as a as a way of looking into the world, as a perspective. I'm wondering, at what point did you encounter that? At what point did you land on the title? Can you talk a little bit about All That Breathes?
So the film was called through its initial stages and right up till the rough cut stage was actually, so it was called Airborne. And that's the, all our folders are called Airborne, our passwords are Airborne,
Well,
like,
don't tell us your passwords.
no worries.
Okay.
So for the longest time, we refer to it as Airborne. But of course, like some of our producing partners pointed out, that word has completely different connotations in the era of a pandemic. And with COVID going airborne, of course, that it had different meanings. Our executive producer David actually found that bit of line and said that why don't we pluck this out and make the title. And the title was actually decided in a tearing hurry in the last week when Sundance accepted it and said, what do we announce? And that's when we were going on brainstorming. And I think the strength of the title, All That Breathes, is that it immediately suggests the broader perspective of the brothers in terms of there being a kind of equal kinship or life itself being a membership or the kind of entangled nature of things and the inherent egalitarianism with which they look at everything that breathes, which they've inherited from their mother. And it sort of encapsulates a lot and also ascribes new meaning to a lot of the shots of animals in the city. So I think it enriches how you approach some of those shots. And you realize that this is not just a film about two brothers making a bird hospital. It's a film that obviously wants to zoom out into something more transcendental. And the title allows you to sort of peg that.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate your time. Well wishes to you, to all those around you, to all those that touched this film, and heartfelt thank you
Oh, likewise.
for the
This was a very
film.
nice conversation. It was very enjoyable, and it was very good to get into the conversation about the film properly. Thank you for that.
Thanks for listening. All That Breathes is currently making rounds in film festivals. For updates on screenings, please visit us at docsinorbit.com or on social media, where we track the films we feature on the podcast. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next episode, featuring a conversation with Jemana Mana about her film Foragers. This episode was produced by Eka Tsotsoria in Tbilisi and Christina Zachariades in Brooklyn, with original music by Naeem Makhboub in Stockholm.